Jump, jump for my love. Jump in for my love. When you want my kisses in the night. Jump, jump for my love. Oh, I didn't see you there. I'm sorry. This is Rish Outfield. And you're listening to the Rish Outcast.
And I sure don't care for irregularity. Tell me why you have to go and make me so constipated. Cause right now I do anything to just get my bowels evacuated. In the bathroom, I sit and I wait and I strain.
This is an episode I nearly called, even though I just started recording it 30 seconds ago. This never happens to me. But, come on. Let's face facts, boys and girls. So instead, I think I'm going to... Oh, hello! So instead, I think I'm going to call it creative constipation.
No, no, no.
Because it is scatological. Yep. So I'm Rish Outfield, and I'm the host of this show, and usually I either present a story or I talk about something topical. Usually it's writing-related, and it is 2018. I have not run. I've forgotten how to speak, ladies and gentlemen. I'm going to talk like this for the next minute or so, just because doing a character that doesn't stammer, it's rather invigorating. It's better than the way I normally speak. So it is 2018, and I haven't done many episodes in 2018, mostly because all of them are left over from 2017, and by the time we get to this one, it will probably be summertime. Have I done the full 30 seconds? I felt like I was in a penalty box there for a minute. I do consider myself a writer most of the time, and you've heard me say it before, you've heard Big Anklevich say it before. What does a writer do? A writer writes. I believe he was quoting Stephen King from On Writing that says, a writer is someone who writes every day. And I tend to go up and down in my productivity as like a roller coaster, maybe, although one of those kiddie roller coasters that never has very high highs. And at least I can depend on the month of February to encourage me, to inspire me, because February is Black History Month. No, because in the middle of February, there's always this writer's conference that I go to, and I always get something out of it, some kind of push, some kind of encouragement, some kind of spark. Being around people who are creative, who write for a living, who desperately would like to write for a living. And it's something that I'm really advantaged as far as the writer's conference goes, because it's about 6 minutes away from where I live, and it's really cheap. I think I've paid like $10 a day to go to it before. This year it was more. I've stopped calling myself a student, so that is part of it. And it seems like there's a third advantage. Oh, and the third advantage is that there are tons of successful writers that live within an hour and a half from the location of this writer's conference. And so, you know, you'll see a lot of familiar faces, people who are struggling, people who are successful. And I usually come out of it just raring to go. Can't wait to be a writer. I think last year I was already writing the Disneyland Tower of Terror, may it rest in peace. I was already on the ascent before the writers' conference even began, where I had been writing every single day, and then I went to the writers' conference and it was like, yeah, okay, here we go, and I just kept it up. Last year, I think, was the year where I wrote for 2 or 3 months in a row, pretty much every single day. It felt good. But this year, 2018, I just have not given a crap. Does that count?
No, no, no.
Oh, singers say that it does. I can't motivate myself to write. And so when I went to this thing, it was a little bit more desperate. I had been sick, and I was just barely getting over it. And it was one of those sicknesses where I was just tired all the time, and I needed to sleep. But it was like, no, I'm going to go to the very first panel, which is at 9 o'clock in the morning. And I had to do the registration beforehand, so I set my alarm so that I would have my badge and be there for the very first panel on the very first day, because I needed, more so than other years, I needed some encouragement. I needed some inspiration. And so I went to the conference. I went to as many panels as I could. In the past, I think I've told you that some of the panels that I go to are the ones that are helping you with your craft, helping you with technique, helping you with being a better writer. And then there are panels that I go to that are just fun, like somebody reading a paper that sounds like it would be enjoyable, or some kind of game, or a panel about a movie or a television franchise that I like or whatever. And it's like, okay, well, that's cool. You know, I just can go to enjoy those panels, but not this year. This year, I only went to the craft ones. You know, there would be panels about Star Wars, panels about Star Trek, panels about Harry Potter, panels about My Mother the Car, panels about Good Times with Jimmy Walker, panels about Manimal, panels about Cletus the Slackjawed Yokel, just the sorts of things that I would enjoy going to. But I told myself, no, I'm going to only go to the ones that are useful and instructive and hopefully will help me. And what I accomplished was that about 2 o'clock, 3 o'clock in the afternoon on every single day of the conference, I started to fall asleep. And to be honest, as soon as the conference was over, I thought, huh, well, that was interesting. I'm not sure if I'm cut out to be a writer. Maybe it's just not for me. I could get on a little side mission here and tell you that a job was offered to me, and it's one of those grown-up jobs with absolutely no pleasure and joy in it. But I was told the job was mine if I wanted it. And I mean, dude, somebody who gets fired from every single job I've ever held like me, and somebody who's also the laziest person in any given room, being told that the job is yours if you want it, I'd be an idiot not to at least consider this job. But like I said, it's not going to be anything enjoyable. In fact, it reminds me of a job that I had in Los Angeles where it was just like, well, look, you need a job, and this is steady, and it's not fun, no, but you go to it, and you work as hard as you can, and maybe they'll notice you, and you'll get one that is more fun. And ultimately, that did happen. I worked my butt off because I had to, because I had no money. I was in financial straits that were tenuous at best. The roommate that I had been sharing rent with got married. And it's like, oh, great. Now what do I do? It's like, well, you live by yourself and you have to make rent, and it's going to be considerably more than it ever has been before. And so I just worked really, really hard at this job that was brain numbing. It was one of those where they hired like 15 of us, and they knew that half of us would not be there 2 months from then. And anyhow, sorry, like I said, that was a side journey. But that job offer came around this time when I thought, you know, maybe I'm not a writer. Maybe I'm not cut out for any of this stuff. I need to just stop and grow up. And I can continue to do audiobooks here and there. But look, this extended childhood thing has to end. And, you know, part of the reason for that, I think, is that I went to so many panels and saw so many familiar faces and heard so many familiar things that I'd already heard before. If you're a Patreon supporter of mine, I did a whole address about it, about this conference and the things that I heard that I had heard 15 times before and the same stories and all that. And that sort of bummed me out because I didn't hear anything new. I didn't hear like the words I had been needing to hear, you know, where, oh, it's like he was inspired to say this because I needed to hear it. None of that happened. So this was the first time in 4 years of going to the conference that I didn't come out of it super excited, raring to go with a renewed determination to write every single day. And boy, that's a shame. Because that's really what I am paying for. Not to get anybody's autograph, not to reunite with friends that I only see at these conferences, but to get a push. What do you call that? Where you used to push the truck and then hit the gas, pump the gas, and the engine would turn over. I don't think that's called a push start, but you know what I'm talking about. That's essentially what I was hoping to get every time I went to that. And I certainly have 3 out of 4 years. And so I found that disheartening. But I figured, well, I can chalk some of that up to being sick. And I was sick for a long time. It was one of those lingering winter colds. I don't know even how to express, you know, it was like 7 or 8 days I was sick. And then there were 2 or 3 days on either side, you know, of leading up to it and getting down from it. I feel like I'm talking about the roller coaster analogy again. So then a few days had passed from the conference. I still hadn't written anything. And you go to these things and you see these people who bust their butts to be writers. You know, people who publish 5 books a year, people who, even if they publish 3 books a year, is a heck of a lot more than anything I have been capable of, and they want it. And I just felt like I didn't want it. And so in desperation, I called Big Anklevich in Houston the other day, and I said to him, hey man, I'm sorry to bother you at work. I tend to say sorry to bother you at work a lot because that's the only time I ever call him. And that's got to suck. But if I were calling him at another time, it'd be like, okay, sorry to call you when you're with your family. Sorry to call you when you're eating. Sorry to call you when you're trying to sleep. Yeah, I mean, if there's going to be any continuation of our friendship, it's going to depend on me calling him and saying sorry to call you. So I called him and I said, hey man, I just can't write. I went to the library yesterday, and the library is a good place for no distractions. You know, I go there, I can just sit in a cubicle and say, you know, I'm not going to get up until I write. And sometimes those chairs are super uncomfortable. And so you're like, okay, you better write quick, pal. And I went, and instead of writing, I edited audio. And I was ashamed of that. And so I called him up and I said, I'm wondering if maybe you would want to collaborate with me on something. Something we can work together on, something where we alternate days or whatever, and I feel the pressure to write. And he basically said no, but he didn't want to discourage me from writing. You know, over 100 times he had heard me try to encourage him, and it never worked. But he's got to remember that I've done that. And so he said, okay, well, hey, how about if we do like a broken mirror thing? And I said, oh, okay, that's not what I wanted, but okay, I guess we can do that. He said, all right, so a Metallica song. We used to always talk about writing, or you used to always talk about writing a story based on a Metallica song, because Big was a huge fan of Metallica, and as a fan, he knew their many song titles, and they've got a ton of songs that are evocative, that put some kind of image in your head, that almost tell a story just from the title. And 10 or 11 years ago, more than that now, holy cow, he and I talked about writing stories based on Metallica song titles, and I had made a list of titles and then had sort of challenged myself. I'd sat down and challenged myself to write up a little paragraph about each one. It's like, what? Okay.
Creeping death.
Ooh, what image does that put in my mind?
You know, the thing that should not be.
Ooh, wow. What story could you base on that? You know, kill them all. Metal militia. Okay, that's stupid. But nothing had ever come of it. That was years ago, and we never wrote, I can speak for both of us.
We never wrote him.
But he proposed that, and he said, look, we'll each write a story inspired by a Metallica song, and we each have 2 weeks to write it, and he came up with some kind of arbitrary date, and I said, well, what happens on that arbitrary date? And he said, well, we'll record them for the Doonstief. And I was just like, holy cow, really, in 2 weeks? I mean, maybe 2 weeks we swap the stories, because that'll give us some time to, you know, give each other notes on them and some time to incorporate the notes before we record them for possible inclusion in the Doonstief. And he's like, okay, yeah, that's cool. And he gave me a date. And I've explained before that with deadlines, those are usually good things for me. They give me a push, if not the push, that I need to go to work, and it did nothing. I sat down and I looked up a bunch of Metallica titles, and there are several that could work, but I didn't write. And I thought about it. I thought about various ideas that I could have. I thought about an idea of a guy who car breaks down in some little town, and it's one of those little towns I love to write about, where something weird happens in this town. And in this town, every full moon, like the third night of the full moon, something comes to town and it takes the person who's the biggest sinner, or it visits the person that's the biggest sinner. I don't know if it kills them or takes them. So there's like, you know, you've got to make sure that you're a righteous man if you're going to spend the night here in this town. And whew, when I put it that way, no wonder I couldn't write that story. That sounds terrible. But I was just looking through song lyrics, and there was one, not lyrics, titles. There was one from the Black Album called My Friend of Misery. And I thought about that, and I was like, huh. Not a friend of misery, but my friend of misery. What does that mean, friend of misery? And I thought about a dream that I had a few years ago where I was back in my childhood home, and in the bedroom that I was in when I was like 10 years old, and my brother came to the door, and he was a child again, and he was freaked out because the boogeyman was in his room, and I yelled at him and told him, you know, that not to bother me, and he went back to his room, and I thought about it, and I felt bad, and I was like, dude, you're back in your childhood house when, you know, you were happy, and you just bit your brother's head off. I'll bet this is something that you did all the time. So I got up, and I got out of bed. I left the room, and I went down to my brother's room, and I heard him talking to someone in there, and I cracked the door, and the boogeyman was in there talking to my brother. And I was just like, holy crap. Anyhow, that was a dream that I had, and it really scared me. I'm not sure that I woke up then or a little farther down in the narrative. But sure enough, the boogeyman was in there with my brother. And I thought, you know, I could probably write a story of this. I certainly wanted to. Years ago when I had this dream, okay, and I didn't do it. I went to the library to force myself to at least start on this story. And I had been thinking about it a lot. I thought, okay, maybe instead of me and my little brother, it's going to be a teenage girl and her little brother. And instead of, you know, taking place then, It would take place now. And she's like on a Skype call with her boyfriend when her brother comes in the door and she yells at him, and she can see from the expression on her boyfriend's face that maybe she was harsh. So she goes to apologize to the boy just to comfort him. And yeah, sure enough, he's talking to somebody. I thought I could write this. I'm not sure where the story will go, but I thought of a couple of different places that it could go. And I went to the library, sat down, and said, okay, write it. And I wrote the first paragraph where the girl is, and instead of on a Skype call, I decided that it was years ago, and that she was listening to a mixtape that this boy that she just, you know, sort of flirting with gave her. And the little brother interrupts that, and of course she bites his head off. But I didn't get any of that. I got the first paragraph where she is listening to a mixtape. And then I stopped. I just couldn't write anymore. I didn't want to write anymore. I blogged about it instead. I went on Facebook. I grabbed Abigail Hilton's audiobook and I edited another chapter. I sat there in those uncomfortable chairs and I didn't write the story. And believe me, I felt just terrible afterward. You know, I felt like a guy who has been on the outs with his wife. They've had a trial separation. And he thinks of all these things that he'll say and do when the two of them get together again. And they get together and he doesn't apologize. He doesn't say, I can do better. He doesn't say, I love you. Please, let's work this out. They just sort of fight. If anything, things are worse. That's how I felt. And I came home from the library. This was yesterday. And I thought, you know, something that people were saying at the writers' conference that I had heard a million times before. Okay, seven times before. People say you need to exercise. You need to get that heart rate going. Move the legs and the arms and the brain will follow. Go for a run, go for a bike ride, go for a walk around the park, and it will help you be a better writer. And so I did. I jogged pathetically about 2.5 blocks to this little house on the corner that has a red door that I love. And anytime I go jogging, which isn't often, but anytime I jog, I always go by that house with the red door because I just like it. I've thought before in the past, you know, if I were ever to buy a house, this is the one I would buy. I just love that red door. I got that, you know, to that, and then I just turned around and I jogged / walked back inside, and I closed the door and I was just like, please let me be inspired now. And I wasn't. I had other things to do. I recorded a short story for Pseudopod. And sometimes reading other people's work can inspire you, or watching something that works or doesn't work can inspire you. In this case, no. Today, I didn't have a ton of time, but I knew I could go to the library again if I wanted to use my free time at the library. And I thought, you know what? I don't care what you want to do. You need to go try to write. Instead of going to the library, I sat down and I had... How in depth do I need to go on this? A friend of mine wrote an erotica novel and was surprised by how well it sold. And I can't write a novel, but I thought, I can try to do that. I can write erotica. I can be a Jedi. Ben, tell him I'm ready. Oh! Sorry, how many times have I made that joke? Yep, too many times. Well done, sir or ma'am. And I had written up, like, a synopsis for a sort of a supernatural erotic story that I could write, and I had started the actual writing of it, you know, taking the synopsis and fleshing it out and putting it in formatting, you know, of past tense and all that stuff. And then I had sort of forgotten about it, abandoned it. It's what I do. It's what I live for. And I saw that today. And it was time to go to the library. I even had put on my jacket. And I saw like a sentence that didn't feel complete. And so I sat down and I fixed that sentence. And then saw like that the whole paragraph was still, you know, in present tense. And it's like, then they kiss. Only it wasn't kiss. And I thought, geez, really? I mean, it's just like, this is the state of this piece? I'm not that I'm ever going to publish it, but I'd like to. And I started fleshing that stuff out, and I looked up, and a half hour had passed. I had missed a half hour of my writing time because I was writing. And I guess that's cool, but it really isn't, because nobody is ever going to see that erotica stuff that I'm writing. Anyway, I saved it. I closed it. I got in the car. I drove over to the... Well, I had to drive to the post office first. I had to stand in line at the post office. But after that, I went to the library, and I had less time than I normally would have. And I just didn't want to write this Metallica story. I sat down and I typed up the part where the brother comes in and she yells at him and he apologizes and leaves. And it just wasn't coming. It wasn't flowing. I didn't feel like it was good. I didn't feel like I was working on something inspired, something to be proud of. It wasn't fun. And I can hear you saying, oh, boo-hoo, it's not supposed to be fun. But boy, when it is fun, it is fun. I have enjoyed writing so much in the past. And yeah, there are times when you force yourself to do it. There are times when it's a chore. But usually, I find something that I'm inspired about. I have something I'm excited about. Something that keeps me going. And today, I just didn't. I ended up writing a sketch, a fake Sean Connery thing. And what else did I do? Oh, I edited two more chapters in that book, which is good, and it's a paid gig, and it needed to be done. But it's not what I was there for. I could have done that anywhere. I was there to write, and yeah, I'm in a bad place. So that's where I'm at. Big was telling me that his nephew, who's a grown man, has been listening to his podcast, has listened to our podcasts over the years, and has been supportive of Big's creative endeavors. And he talked to him recently and asked him how his writing has been going. Did you ever finish that novel? And Big told him no. And the kid didn't get it. He said, why don't you write? I thought you loved it. And Big tried to explain to him, I do love it, but it's still work. And I have this full-time job, and I have this long commute, and I have a shitload of kids, and I just can't bring myself to do more work on top of that. And I felt that that was kind of profound, because I get it. That's how I feel as well a lot of the time. I mean, you know me, I also have the disadvantage of being either terrified or apathetic about sharing my work. Like I was saying about the erotica project that I worked on, more than I worked on the project that has a deadline today, if I ever finish that, I will have a sense of accomplishment, and that's as far as it'll go. I just don't care whether nobody else reads it or not. And I don't care if it doesn't make me any money or not. But having said that, finding out that somebody liked something that I wrote or that somebody bought something that I wrote feels good. It's just not the ultimate goal. And doing this podcast is a creative outlet for me, as you know. And it differs from writing in that if I recorded this and I never put it out there, I would feel like it was wasted time. But if I wrote a story or a novella and nobody ever read it, I still feel like, well, I wrote that and I'm proud of it, or I'm happy with it, or I'm not happy with it, but I'm still glad that I did it. It was not a waste of time. At this point, I don't think I'm ever going to change. I guess in the 100th episode, I talked about that, that I've been doing this for long enough that I'm aware of my own limitations. And they bum me out. But I'm not sure I'm ever going to change. I was reading an interview with Harlan Ellison. Gosh, was that today? I think it was. And he talked about just how terrible his childhood was, and that he was very unhappy as a child, and he acted out because of it, and he was troublesome, and he made trouble for his parents, and rebelled a lot, and his dad just didn't understand him, and then his dad died when Ellison was a teenager, and he never got to reconcile with his father. And yeah, let me just give you a little aside here. I've always had a real problem with Harlan Ellison. He has always struck me as the worst kind of egotist, the worst kind of horse's ass, pompous, blowhard, bully. I talked many times about the kind of writer who can stand up and say, buy my book, it will change your life. Buy my book, it's better than any of the other books on the shelf. These other writers that are on the panel with me right now, I'm sure they're all fine, but none of them have ever written anything as good as my book. And I detest people like that. I have always had a problem with them. But there have been people that have done it much more nicely, and I've still complained a little bit about that. But Ellison is not nice. He's just not a nice man. But reading that interview today, I felt for him, and I thought, wow, maybe I've been wrong about Harlan Ellison all this time. I mean, he's certainly a good writer. I haven't read a lot of his stuff, but I've read some of his short stories, and he's got talent, and he writes a lot, which cannot be said of me. But since I'm telling you this anyway, let me tell you that he went on in that interview to say, my great regret is that my father didn't live to see what a huge success I'd become, to see my accolades, my sales, to see Hollywood come courting. You know, he didn't get to see that I was right. And that deflated the balloon something awful for me in the article. He had shown that he was human. And my heart went out to him, and I thought, you know, I'm going to give this guy another chance. I've read all these interviews where he's acted like such an asshole. But in this, he's coming off as a vulnerable human being, and I respect vulnerability. And then he went and, you know, put on his cowboy hat and strutted, jangled his spurs. And I was like, oh, okay. For a moment there, I felt like he and I had something in common, because my father died and I know that I was a failure in his eyes. He never understood me, and I'm fairly sure I didn't understand him. But, you know, when he died, I wrote that story about the kid, the man who after his father's funeral goes back in time and plays with his father. They're both children and they play together. And I thought of that story when Ellison was being interviewed, because he had written a story, and gosh, I can't remember what it was called. Like a life furnished in early poverty or something like that. About a man who goes back in time and gets to interact with himself as a child and his father before he died. And it made me think of my story, and I was just like, wow, we're similar in that. I think I'm digressing, guys. No, no,
no. You know, let's get a special guest in here. Maybe that will make things flow a little faster, easier, smoother.
Did someone say smooth?
Fake Sean Connery. Come right over here, please, sir.
Yes, Rish, what can I do for you?
Well, Sir Sean, I have a Metallica song-inspired short story that I have to write. I've got a deadline, and I don't feel inspired. I don't know where it's going. I'm not all in, you know, on the idea.
And you think I can help you in some way, lad?
I know you can.
Well?
No. It's your turn. Please inspire me.
That's it? You just want me to... Give me that microphone. All right, lad. What's the name of your song?
The song is called My Friend of Misery.
Is that an insult? Am I your friend of misery? Is that what you're saying?
No, I hadn't thought of that, but yeah, I mean, you kind of are.
You're welcome. All right, let's take a look at the lyrics to this Metallica song.
Metallica is pronounced Metallica.
Shut up, you. My friend of misery. You just stood there screaming, fearing no one was listening to you. They say the empty can rattles the most. The sound of your own voice must soothe you, hearing only what you want to hear, and knowing only what you've heard. You're smothered in tragedy, and you're out to save the world. Misery.
Misery?
You insist that the weight of the world should be on your shoulders. Misery.
Misery.
There's much more to life than what you see, my friend of misery.
Well, thank you, Fake Sean.
You still stood there screaming.
Sorry.
No one caring about these words you tell. My friend, before your voice is gone, one man's fun is another's hell.
Wow, that was great, Fake Sean. I really...
These times are sent to try men's souls.
Oh, he's not done.
But something's wrong with all you see. You take it on all yourself. Remember, misery loves company.
Say it with me, lad. Misery.
You insist that the weight...
No, that's just my part.
You insist that the weight of the world should be on your shoulders. Now,
misery.
There's much more to life than what you see. My friend of misery.
My friend of misery.
Yes. How you feel now, boy?
Mildly aroused.
I mean, concerning your story.
Great. Great, thank you. It's all solved. I appreciate it.
You'd better. Here's your microphone back.
Thank you, Fake Sean.
All right, that didn't help.
Sorry about that. Had to take a break, and then I forgot what I was doing.
I honestly don't remember what I was saying.
Last thing I can remember, I was running for the door. Had to find a path. Oh, creative something. I had gone for a jog, right? Thinking that would get my brain a-going. And it didn't. It just made me tired. It started being scary. I mean, I don't want to say that writing is the thing I'm good at, the only thing I'm good at, but I that's where I was going. You do something well, and that defines you, and then you start to wonder, if I can't do that thing anymore, who am I? What am I to do? I don't want to say it was scary, it wasn't terrifying, but that deadline loomed, and I wasn't going to make it. And Big, very impressively, started writing, and he's like, yeah, this is going to be a good Doonstief episode. And when he says stuff like that, I take it with a grain of salt. But He was writing and I wasn't. I felt like it was a solid idea, but I didn't want to write it. And I didn't know how to make myself want to. I'm just staring off into space because it's still a question that I don't have an answer for. How do you make yourself want to do something that you're supposed to do? Maybe that is a question that has plagued men, human beings, forever. Ultimately, I tried again. And it took a while to want to do it. And part of it was that I didn't know where the story was going to go. What was going to happen with the brother? What was the boogeyman going to be like? What was the girl going to be like if I start her out as kind of a nasty person, or, you know, self-centered, or, I'm sorry, a teenage girl? Do you lose your audience right there? I remember seeing a movie in the 90s with Mary Stuart Masterson in it, who I liked, and they had a wrong-headed move in the first scene, and I was like, oh, okay, so this is not a very nice person. And I couldn't deviate from that, in my opinion. I was just like, oh, we're supposed to like her. Oh, she's crying. Oh, so she has a heart. But why did you start it that way then? Anyhow, these are questions that plagued me. Where was the story going to go? And finally, I had enough. I don't want to say momentum. I was far enough into it that I wanted to know the answer, that I wanted to see where it was going. And I called Big again, probably said, hey, sorry to bother you at work. Sorry to bother you on the toilet. And I said, I'm not going to make it. I am writing, but I'm not going to make this deadline. Can we extend it? And Big said, well, you know, I'm going to be out of town or I'm working on something else. When that deadline was hit, it was just an arbitrary date that we picked because we used to record on Mondays and now, you know, we don't. But it's still in my mind that Monday is the day that we do this thing. So, yeah, it doesn't have to be Monday. How about if it's Friday? So he gave an extra 4 days and I didn't have enough time to finish the story because it just started spiraling out of control. I got it in my head that this was going to be something that went on for months or years. Not the writing process, but this relationship, this thing with the girl and her brother. And so I just felt, oh shoot, this is not near to the end at all. But I felt like, well, okay, there's a place I can stop and then send him what I've got and let him know, hey, Big, I did my, I'm not going to say homework. I fulfilled the spirit of the law, if not the letter of the law, in our collaboration, our writing project. And so, just one second.
Hello there. Rich Outfield, the pod... No. Rich Outfield, the editor, not the podcaster here. Unfortunately, it's happened again. This episode was broken up into 5 parts. Creative Constipation 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5. And as I started compiling it for the editing, I discovered that the 5th part, the last part where I summed up what has been going on, what my attitude was, it was empty. It was blank. It was a few minutes of silent recording. And how that happens is that I have a lapel mic that I've started using because it's not quite as noisy as the handheld mic that I often record with while I'm driving. You get the engine noise, the sound of the car, the sound of the tires going over surfaces, but then you also have to deal with the microphone jostling, with something rubbing against it, with my shirt hitting it. So with that handheld mic, lots of times I'd just put it in like the shirt pocket, or I would jam it into the seat belt, which would hold it right there under my neck. And that's fine except for it would make noise. And sometimes it's impossible to cut out those little noises because they're while I'm talking. And yeah, I'm sorry about that. Like right now you can hear the turn signal. But I got the idea of, okay, well, I'm going to take a lapel mic that's much more focused. It's set up to record my voice rather than the sounds around me or whatever it might catch. And the sound does come out a little cleaner on the lapel mic. But you've got to remember to turn it on. And if you have turned it on, then the battery starts to run out. And if you forget to turn it off, then the battery is dead and you have to go find some place that sells those little tiny batteries to replace it. And so it's beaten me, it's beaten Big Anklevich, it's beaten us before, the little lapel mic. And it did it again on the fifth part of Creative Constipation. So the part where I stop and tell you that I just had so much difficulty writing, but I've got to do it. I'm going to force myself to do it. I'm going to continue to try to do it because I said I would. Well, that's gone. So basically, I'm going to say it now, that month that I was going to write every single day, I was going to write the project and swap it with Big Anklevich, I did end up writing that. And it ended up being much, much longer than I planned. The deadline was looming, and so I thought, well, I'll just split the story into two. So it'll be a novella, but I'll split it into two short stories that together make a more complete novella. And that I can send to Big Anklevich. And I still never did. Here we are, ready to release this episode, and I still haven't sent it to him. Which is crappy, I guess, of me. It's not intentional. It's just the way that I write, with part of it being a notebook, part of it being emailing to myself, part of it being on a file on my crap top, it doesn't lend itself to sharing with other people, at least not immediately. You have to find a way to combine all the parts, make sure that they feel like they're not written at different places and different times, but were all written chronologically at the same sitting. And, you know, that's something that I never really appreciated about writers. But somebody like George R. R. Martin, that takes years to write something, Patrick Rothfuss, that takes years to write a novel, when you read the novel, it should feel like he just wrote it all at the same time. You know, like it just flowed from his head or from his pen. And that takes work. That takes doing. They have to finesse some of the language. Probably they have to make little adjustments here or there, keeping characters consistent, keeping place names consistent, this time of year, trying to avoid repetition. That's something that I discover in editing, is that, you know, oh, hey, I used this phrase, or I said almost the exact same thing earlier in the story. But because I write it the way I do, little bits and pieces over a long period of time, you can't keep straight. Oh, okay, I've already written this. But I did eventually finish the story. I just failed in the goal, which was to have it done really quickly, to write hard and write fast, and then swap stories, because Big wanted to run them on the Doonstief. So I'm a success and a failure. That's it. I'm just going to stop right here. This episode is actually quite long, even without the 15 minutes that were lost. And there's more to come. So thank you for listening. Rish Outfield, goodbye. Rish Outfield here. From the future! 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 We don't watch movies anymore. We have our entertainment fed directly into our brain with video waves. Vaves is what the young people call them now. And then they're great. It's really neat because you can choose, you know, like I want the 4-hour version of Return of the King, or, you know, I want the 3-hour version, or I want, you know, a shortened version, and it just gets beamed there. The only downside really is that about 1 in 100 vaves causes the person's brain to explode. And the first few times that it happened, holy crap.
But we're used to it now. You know, it's the price you pay. It's the risk you run to watch your reality show. Actually, this is just being recorded after the events of this episode have taken their course. And I did end up finishing the story, the My Friend of Sanity, My Friend of Misery. It ended up taking a long time, and it was lots longer than I intended for it to be. But I did finally finish it. And yeah, it's like three times longer than I thought it would be when I started writing. But, you know, if you were somebody who was paid by the word or paid by the page, that'd be great. With me, it's just like, well, it's going to be more work to do the audio, more work to do rewrites. And I thought it would be neat, you know, just as a little bonus here, to read to you the first page, the first scene of the piece. So that's what I'm going to do now.
Enjoy.
Brielle was halfway through the mix CD Adam Bleeker had sent her, listening to some guy named Henley vow her worthless evenings were over, when her little brother burst into the room. He was 9 years old and had never learned how to knock. Brent, she yelled, certainly too late for 12:30. This was not the most embarrassing time he had come in. That had been when she was shaving her armpits one time, but it still could have been worse. Not that that excused it.
Bree, Bree, the boy said, you gotta help me. Yeah, I'll help you into the emergency room, you little.
He came into the room, beside her bed, looking very scared and very small. Not having his glasses on might have contributed to that. He'd worn glasses since he was 3, and it always gave him a more mature look.
I saw him, Bree. I saw him in my room.
Brielle scowled. You better not say Justin Bieber, you snot-nosed little... He interrupted, tears gleaming in his big eyes.
The boogeyman. He was in my room.
Oh, for God's sake. This was worse than the old Bieber joke.
You had a bad dream, she began. No, I didn't. Go bother Mom and Dad, she whispered,
suddenly aware that she, too, was supposed to be asleep at this hour.
They won't believe me,
whined the boy.
Then go to bed, Brielle hissed.
Brent looked like he was going to argue, but instead he slowly backed out of the room. He whispered something that might have been, sorry, and closed the door. Brielle went back to her mixtape, but only for a minute. Some of the joy seemed to have gone out of the listening, and she just kept hearing that little whimpered sorry from her little brother. Ew. I'm sorry, guys. I just have to fix. When there's problems this ugly. I'll bet it's not late for 12:30. It's loud. And she just kept hearing that tiny whimpered sorry from her little brother. Brent had always had health problems, a side effect of being born so premature. And due to that, he got tons of attention in the family. Brielle had often been jealous of him and exasperated with him, but now she just felt pity for him. He had come to her with a bad dream, and instead of comforting him like a big sister was supposed to do, she'd sent him packing, like one of those nasty rich girls she went to school with. She couldn't help but glance toward her memento shelf at the porcelain ballerina there. Brent had given that to her, had spent a whole royalty on getting it programmed with her favorite song, when the most she'd ever gotten him was a box of comic books off Craigslist. Okay, so now we have 4 paragraphs of backstory about how she was a child actress, was never any good at it, and then her brother became a child actor and is extraordinarily successful, and how she's been jealous of him. Then, most of this didn't go through Brielle's mind as she sat there in the bed, staring at the ballerina. She considered just ignoring him, laying back since it was past time she should be sleeping. But she didn't. She paused her music, got up, and adjusted her nightgown.
She opened the door a crack, just in case her parents were up. Brent could have gone in their room, after all. But the hallway was dark. No sound came from her mom and dad's room at the end of the hall. Brent's room was across from hers, what had been her father's exercise room before Brent came along. She crept down the carpet, not really sure why she was being so sneaky. It just seemed natural late at night, though she wasn't really up to anything on this particular occasion, and reached for Brent's doorknob. Then she stopped. Someone inside was speaking, and it was not her little brother.
"Afraid of me?"
a voice was whispering. A male voice. Maybe it was her brother's iPad, and he was watching one of those effed-up Japanese cartoons he liked. She turned the knob.
"Yes, indeed,"
the voice said, as Brielle pushed open her brother's door. The room was dark, except for the glow from Brent's fish tank on the dresser. But there was no one she could see in the room. "Brent?" The boy was huddled in his bed, his legs pulled up to his chest, the covers up over his head. Brielle flipped on the light. No, nobody else was in the room. Slowly, the boy pulled the blanket from his head. He was sweaty, his eyes big and tearful.
"Brielle?"
"What's going on?" she asked, not really whispering now.
"You okay?"
He swallowed, sniffled, and met her eyes.
"Did you see him?"
"See who?" she asked, then added,
"No."
Brent's eyes went to the closet.
"He was in here, I promise."
The closet door was closed. Brielle also swallowed.
"Who was in here? You know who."
Was she going to make him say it?
"There's nobody in here now."
She tried to imagine what Mom would do, and the answer was obvious. With the light on, she'd cross the room, complain about the boys' toys being all over the floor, and pull open the closet, revealing that nothing and nobody was lurking inside. But what if there was? She'd heard a voice.
"You've got to believe me,"
Brent pleaded from the bed. He sounded like a toddler rather than a second grader. So Brielle crossed the bedroom, stepping over Pokemon plushies and Star Wars ships, and reached the closet. She glanced back at her brother, and it was all too easy to imagine those doors opening and a grown-up arm grabbing her and pulling her in.
"It's nothing,"
she made herself say. She turned back to the closed closet doors and heard something shift on the other side.
So there's that scene, that excerpt. Because it's been so long since I recorded this episode, this is the Creative Constipation one, right? I'm not sure how in detail I went with where this story came from, other than Big challenging me. I'm sure I mentioned that. But as you know, if you've listened to me on this show or on the Dune Steve, I have a real difficulty putting myself out there, sharing my stuff where there's the possibility that somebody will tell me that it's not good, that I wasted my time, that I should, why bother trying? And it has really hampered my ability to put my work out there once it's complete. I have a sense of finality, a sense of completion. I feel the pride of achievement when I write the end. And that pride is not enhanced by publishing things. You know, it's like, oh, I made something available. You can buy it on iTunes. You can buy it on Amazon. That doesn't feel better than just writing the end. And so a lot of times I don't. And you've heard me use excuses over the years of, you know, I need to copy it from the notebook. I need to do one more draft. Oh, I don't have any cover art for it. Well, the cover art that I have is crappy. These are excuses that I've used many times. And I guess that's a roundabout way of saying that even though I just read to you the first page of this piece, It doesn't mean that it's available on Audible for you to go buy. I mean, a while ago, I read you guys the first couple pages of 10,000 Coffins, and that's still not available to buy. My friend Austin, the one that's a really, really fine artist, but is literally incapable of finishing anything, I asked him if he would do the cover work for 10,000 Coffins. And I did a sketch of what I wanted it to look like. And he's like, oh, that sounds great. Yeah, that'll be cool. And the next day he sent me like a mock-up of how he saw it. And it was already just, you know, whatever you call mock-up version, like a very rough version. It was already better than anything I could create. And so I was like, yeah, yo, wow, that looks really, really good. If you wouldn't mind putting a hand in it here, you know, we'll call it good. And he's just like, oh, yeah, this is just a mock-up. This isn't the final art. Yeah, I just wanted to make sure before I proceeded. And so I was like, cool. And he asked me, when do you need this by? Because I had told him, well, I still need to do the audio before I'm able to put this up for sale. And he's like, when will that be? And I have no idea when that will be. I typed up all the stuff that was in the notebook. And then I looked it over, and I think that there were a couple of parts where I thought, oh, shoot, the narrative jumps here. I must have written this in another notebook, or I must have written this somewhere. Oh, I've got to figure that out. And then I need to do another draft, and then do the audiobook. And I don't know if I'll ever do that. I mean, I know that Austin's not going to get me the art soon. I almost said ever. That's not polite. But I just felt like, well, if I had the cover art right here in front of me, then I would feel pressure. Not internal pressure, but external pressure. It's like, he did this cover. I owe it to him to put out the art, to make it available. And I think I was using that as another crutch for not releasing, but for not working on it. Because like I said, I felt really good when I completed it. It's been over a year now, I think, since I finished this project. And I still feel good. I felt like, oh, hey, that was well written. And it was unlike anything I'd ever done. Cool. See, you know, I know that professional writers, that real writers, they get that thrill of, you know, I had finished it. There's a secondary thrill when they finish the final draft, you know, and send it off to the publisher. There's a thrill when it becomes available. And then they get a thrill with residuals or royalties. They get a thrill with, you know, how it's selling. It's like, oh, this is a bestseller on Amazon, you know, with women having sex with trees subgenre of fantasy or romance. And then I guess there are probably some that get another thrill when, like, awards get announced and they're on there. You know, I don't get any of that. Really weird. I guess it's a roundabout way of saying that even though I just read to you from My Friend of Misery, and every time I say My Friend of Misery, it sounds more wrong. It sounds more like that shouldn't be the title. And I'm not sure what to do there, because that was kind of the deal I made with Big, is that, well, I don't know that he said it had to be named after, right? Did he? Had to be inspired by the title of, we can talk about that later. I just think it would be neat if one day I was just like, no, dang it, the story is not done until it has been published. I'm sure there are writers that are like that. It's like, okay, I wrote all these things, but none of them are completed until they are sold. I like that. Anyway, thank you again for listening twice. Well, you only listened once, but this was two different time periods. Thanking you again. Be not miserable.
The Rish Outcast was produced under a Creative Commons 3.0 license, which makes it free to listen to, share, and poke fun at. but the podcast cannot be altered or sold. The music in this episode was provided by Kevin MacLeod, the podcaster's friend. His work can be found over at incompetech.com, also under a Creative Commons license. If you didn't completely despise this episode, why don't you support the show with our Patreon fund over at patreon.com? Every dollar gives me more strength to put out the